Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the rapid turnover of White House staff and cabinet members is showing no sign of slowing down. So this hour, we want to give that some historical context, a look at past presidents and their closest advisors, meaning cabinet members and White House staff. Joining us to do that is Tim Walsh, presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in our Iowa City studio. Tim, welcome back.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be with you.
I always enjoy these comparisons of the present with the past in American presidential history. Donna Hoffman with us as well, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa in Cedar Falls. Hi, Donna.
Hi, Ben. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. During this hour, a lot of interesting aspects of presidents, their advisors, their cabinet, their staff to cover. During this hour, I think I can promise you from either Tim or Donna, we'll hold off. We'll keep the tension here and answer to a couple of trivia questions, including who said this. There are also unknowns, the ones we know we don't know. Or from another presidential advisor, I'm in charge here. So I'll let you ponder those and pick those out during the hour. The answers will be forthcoming, I guarantee it. Let's start off with you, Tim. Talk about how the cabinet was seen by our founding fathers, and how much different is it than what we have today?
Well, going back to the summer of 1788, when the Congress was, or the convention was trying to put together the Constitution, there was, certainly was a determination to have an executive. We were going to have a chief executive, a president. And the assumption, in fact, the language seems to indicate that the president may establish departments as needed and appoint individuals to assist him. It wasn't clear among the framers exactly what this group would constitute. Would it be a privy council? Would it be a cabinet? And it was left to George Washington to decide. And so the first four cabinet offices are Secretary of State, Secretary of the Treasury, Secretary of War, and the Attorney General. So you have the big four, and those are the four that have the kind of status within the kind of pecking order.
And Secretary of War is now
Secretary of Defense. And yes. In fact, that's the good point, because in effect these departments have grown or shrunk, and their status has grown or shrunk depending upon the needs of the country. So you don't have another cabinet office established after 1789 until I think it's 1849. The Department of Department of the Interior is established in 1849, mm-hmm. and then in 1862 the Department of Agriculture, but it's not considered a cabinet level office, not until 1889, and then you go until 1903 when you have Commerce and Labor together, and then 1913 they break Commerce and Labor apart, and it goes on and on. And as the size of the executive branch has grown, particularly after World War II, but even during the New Deal and the various responsibilities of the executive branch, you see a greater increase in the number of advisors. The question is, who is a cabinet member? Who's closest to the president? And how is the president going to meet with those individuals? Washington thought, well, I'll just meet with them one-on-one. But he realized that he drew a lot of benefit from having both Hamilton, who was Secretary of the Treasury, and Thomas Jefferson, who was Secretary of State, in the room, where you have a kind of point-counterpoint. And so that kind of advice helped Washington. And so what you have then is a collective meeting of cabinet officers. But as the growth of the cabinet, increased, you have a lot of dysfunction. And so you've got now 15 cabinet members currently, and then you've got an additional 8 individuals who have, quote, cabinet rank, the director of intelligence and the head of the EPA, for example, has cabinet mm-hmm. rank. Well, they don't all have common issues. So in effect, you don't have issues, and so it becomes kind of pro forma in terms of people sitting around a table. The press comes in, clicks a lot of pictures. The president's meeting with his cabinet. And then once the photo op is over, they go their separate ways. Generally speaking, cabinet members are allowed to run their departments, and as needed, either somebody on the president's staff will intercede if the president wants something, or if the cabinet secretary really needs the face-to-face time, then he'll push to get into the White House.
Donna Hoffman, what's your read on how our advisors to the president, the cabinet, the White House staff has evolved? What jumps out at you?
Well, you know, and one thing to make the point here is that while we have the heads of those executive agencies currently, we're at 15, those other offices can fluctuate on and off because presidents can add those or subtract those kind of at will. And so, you know, for example, even in the Obama administration, the chair of the Council of Economic Advisors had cabinet rank but doesn't currently. And so these things can kind of ebb and flow, if you will, depending on what the president wants. So it is a creature of the president in that kind of sense. But one of the things that we ought to point out here is a couple of things. One, you know, there's no requirement the president meet the cabinet collectively. As Tim was saying, you know, sometimes it might be better to meet individually with cabinet members. There is this advisory capacity that we think of with cabinet members. But when we're thinking of the heads of the 15 executive agencies, they also have to run their agency. They have an administrative task, too. So not only are they advising on policy, but they're running their agency. And some of these agencies are, you know, quite large, tens of thousands of people. And they have to implement the policy. And so on the advising side, they're looking at policy formation. On the administrative side, they're looking at policy implementation. Now, what we have seen over time is that policy advice has come to be eclipsed by people in the executive office of the president or people we typically call the White House staff.
Mm-hmm.
And this really starts back in the Franklin Roosevelt administration when he convenes a committee called the Brownlow Committee to study the issue of presidential administration, basically. And they return in 1937 this recommendation that the president needs help. That was a quote from that particular committee. And Congress initially doesn't do anything here. It was on the heels of FDR's court packing plan. And eventually, though, in 39, I believe it is, that he is able to create, through executive order, the Executive Office of the President, and thus starts then this kind of adding on of presidential staff. And these staff, White House staffers, are physically even closer mm-hmm. to the president as well.
And that makes a difference.
It does make a difference, because if you've ever been to Washington, D.C., and you think about the layout of Washington, D.C., you know, you go down the various streets, there's the Secretary of the Treasury. It's not right there close to the White House. It's relatively close, but it's not like you're walking across the sidewalk. The Department of Defense, you know, is across the river. And so even physically, these agencies are separated from the president. But the White House staff are either in the West Wing, or they might be in the old Executive Office Building, or the Eisenhower Executive Office Building, as it's known now, right next door. And so physically, they're even closer. So this has caused even some consternation among cabinet members, people who are those secretaries of. And Robert Reich was Bill Clinton's labor secretary.
Oh, mm-hmm.
And he wrote a book called Locked in the Cabinet after he was done with his tenure. And he got at this tension between the White House staffers and the cabinet secretaries. And I'm going to read a quote here from this book.
Mm-hmm.
How to set that up is essentially a White House staffer told him he needed to go to, I think it was Cleveland, told him he needed to go somewhere out into the United States to do essentially something for the White House, to do some kind of event. And this is what Robert Reich writes about this. Orders from twerps in the White House didn't bother me at the beginning. Now I can't stomach snotty children telling me what to do. From the point of view of the White House staff, cabinet officials or provincial governors presiding over alien primitive territories, anything of any importance occurs in the imperial palace within the capital city. The provincial governors are important only in a ceremonial sense. They wear the colors, they show the flag. Occasionally, they are called in to get their next round of orders before being returned to their outposts. They are, of course, dazzled by the splendor of the court and grateful for the chance to visit. And one of the things that this Reich quote gets at is the notion that, indeed, a lot of White House staffers are probably younger than those cabinet officials.
And maybe some of them are twerps.
And probably so.
Who tweet.
Yes. But they get their position, you know, largely because they worked on the campaign, and that is kind of a young person's job. And so they, you know, they work their way into the White House, and there's a lot of tension there. Because these people in the White House staff really have eclipsed that advice-giving policy, that policy advice And then the you know, cabinet officials are doing the administrative piece of it. I mean, sure, they're still kind of giving advice, right, but really their real job is to implement that policy.
Donna Hoffman with us, a professor of political science at UNI. Tim Walsh, presidential historian. We're looking at the White House staff, the presidential cabinet throughout history, how it's evolved. Some interesting outtakes, interesting insights. Tim, you wanted to jump in there.
Well, I did, and Donna is so right. I mean, we had a popular television show a few years, The West Wing, and really that's where all of these minions, these twerps, so to speak, hang out at their little clubhouse, and they fight for the closest desk or office cubbyhole to the Oval, as they call it, because proximity to power can be seen as power. That was one of Richard Neustadt, the great political scientist, used to say. And so really, when you have access to the Oval Office the way some people do, it makes you a powerful individual.
I wanted to play President Trump's, I guess, his introduction of his cabinet in 2017 and perhaps have you comment on that, because it certainly made news what he did here. And I'll just let it speak for itself. The president's cabinet in June of 2017 had come together. He allowed the cabinet members to introduce themselves and offer praise during his first full cabinet meeting. Let's hear a little bit of it.
Maybe start with Mike, and we'll just go around and just you name your position, and then we'll ask these folks to go back and have a good day, and we're going to discuss our various reports. Mike?
Thank you, Mr. President, and just the greatest privilege of my life is to serve as vice president to a president who's keeping his word to the American people. Assembling a team that's bringing real change, real prosperity, real strength back to our nation.
Thank you, Mike.
Mr. President, I'm privileged to be here, deeply honored, and I want to thank you for keeping your commitment to the American workers. This week is a full schedule for you, focusing on the American worker. We're very excited at the Department of Labor and the apprenticeship program.
Okay, it goes on for quite a while, making news back in June of 2017. Donna, why did that stand out?
Well, you know, this was Trump's first convening of the full cabinet. And, you know, again, this is not unique to Trump that it's a photo opportunity. But what was unique to Trump, and this is why it got remarked on, is that they went around the table and basically everybody sang their praises of President Trump. And that's really kind of an unusual setup, if you will, for that particular meeting, and that's why it got a lot of commentary.
Tim.
Interesting point, if there's value there. Of course, they started with Mike Pence, the vice president.
Right.
The vice president was not a member of the president's cabinet initially because he was, an officer of the Senate. And that angered and irritated John Adams, our first vice president. Vice presidents draw their power and influence from the president. And in this case, Vice President Pence, you know, is bound to President Trump, whether he likes it or not. That's where his authority comes from.
Okay, let's get a little excerpt from the president prior to Trump, President Obama. His press opportunity after his first cabinet meeting. It's interesting in the visuals here. We'll hear about a minute of it. The Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, seated to his immediate right. Let's hear a little bit of President Obama in April of 2009.
Well, I just had my first official cabinet meeting. We have one future cabinet member missing, but everybody else is president accounted for. I delivered a few messages. Number one. I am extraordinarily proud of the talent, the diversity, and the work ethic of this team. In an unprecedented situation where we had to hit the ground running and get an enormous amount done in the first 3 months, everybody here has performed, I think, at the highest levels. And I'm extraordinarily proud of the quality of this cabinet. Number two, I emphasized to this cabinet that we have had to take some extraordinary steps in order to shore up our financial system and to deal with an unprecedented economic crisis.
Okay, taking us up back about 10 years, if we remember that economic crisis, the worst since the Great Depression, that was on President Obama's doorstep when he entered that in April of 2009, after he'd been in office for a few months there. Talk about the fact that, well, we have Hillary Clinton sitting to his right, Tim, and this goes back to that phrase, team of rivals, which has an earlier history.
Absolutely. It goes back to team of rivals as a concept, really goes back to the 1860s with the cabinet of Abraham Lincoln. And, of course, you have within that cabinet individuals. Lincoln was self-confident enough to select people for his cabinet who had been his rivals for the presidency. So William Seward, the governor of New York, became Secretary of State, for example. Salmon Chase, who was our first Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury, eventually becomes Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, but also another candidate for President of the United States. So he was confident to have individuals in a room who obviously had questioned Lincoln's own ability as an executive, but he felt he could work with them. And he was wise enough to be able to both flatter them and direct them as necessary and get them to work together. So it did become a team. And what's interesting about that term that Doris Kearns Goodwin uses for the title of the book is it's both a team and they remain rivals, and rivals of one another as well as the president himself. What is also interesting is that, of course, once Lincoln is assassinated and Andrew Johnson becomes president, it becomes the cabinet from hell, because, in effect, Johnson cannot appoint, because of instruction from the Congress, cannot appoint his own cabinet. And he was a difficult man to deal with at best. And, of course, it leads to Johnson's impeachment and narrowly defeating or surviving the trial in the Senate. Mm-hmm. So it can be a disaster, but it was a great success for Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. Donna, when you think about this concept of a team of rivals and think about presidents, do presidents use this to their advantage more than others? Some use it and some want people who are, so to speak, only on their team.
Certainly, although there is, a relatively recent tradition where the president usually has at least one person in their cabinet who is of the opposite political party. But this is something that has changed, historically. If we go back to the early part of the country in the 1830s, especially when the political parties were gaining ascendance, and we have the quote-unquote smoke-filled rooms in terms of how nominations, for example, at conventions were bartered for, basically. Some of those bartering chips were oftentimes cabinet positions. And so you might have a president come in who did not trust their cabinet officials at all because they were foisted upon them by the political party or some other things. And so you have some alternatives, like we get the term the kitchen cabinet and various things.
What does that mean, Donna?
That was from Andrew Jackson, who had a group that was actually at the time a derogatory term that the press, I believe, applied to the unofficial advisors around him. So it was his kitchen cabinet, because he wasn't really relying much on his official cabinet. And so various presidents, we think of FDR's brain trust, perhaps, oftentimes have these back channel or informal advisory bodies that sometimes get some criticism, but certainly are people that they rely on for advice that may be, again, in that unofficial capacity. But in particular, one of the, and I think that the times kind of affect this. So going back to that Obama clip, I mean, as we ended with that unprecedented economic crisis with, Hillary Clinton then sitting there, his rival for the nomination, presenting a united front was important, because this was a really pretty scary time, if people remember back to that. The other thing this photo opportunity could do, besides present kind of that united front, was to, highlight the calmness of the situation, the capability of the people around the table in handling that crisis in hopefully calm and rational way.
Mm-hmm. When we think about a cabinet meeting, I don't know, Tim, how much function it serves to have these cabinet members all sitting around, other than for a press opportunity, as we heard there, President Obama sitting next to Hillary Clinton. But you mentioned before, I think we started, that the seating is ordained.
Generally speaking, although obviously the order in the Trump clip we had, where the Secretary of Labor was speaking second, would not have been the case in other administrations. You start first with the vice president, and then you would start with the next would be the Secretary of State, and then Treasury, and then and then so forth. So it was one of those kind of miscues, I suppose. The meetings themselves just don't serve any real function because, of course, the departments are so different from one another. And so it is, even in the best of administrations, any kind of cabinet meeting is going to be a kind of a formal affair.
Mm-hmm. Donna, talk about the fact, how does who in the cabinet needs to be, do all cabinet members need to be confirmed by the Senate? White House staff not? Is that the division?
Well, it depends, again, on who's there. So the cabinet secretaries certainly do. But, you know, you may have the chief of staff there, and that's somebody who isn't confirmed by the Senate. And so, again, those cabinet ranking officials will, generally speaking, have gone through cabinet through Senate confirmation. But, you know, somebody like the chief of staff has not. And so, you know, this is, again, something where, to get back to that point about what kind of purpose does this big, large collective body serve, you know, a photo op is one of those things. That's not, as we saw with the Obama example, not nothing, if you'll excuse the double negative there. But at the same time, we have presidents like John Kennedy was quoted at one point as saying, cabinet meetings are simply useless. Why should the Postmaster General, who was on the cabinet at that point, sit here and listen to a discussion about the problems of Laos? And so what that you know, gets to is these people individually around that table may still be quite important. Collectively, that forum may not be that useful, but sub-cabinets are often used, especially in relationship to national security. Or maybe you have, you know, particular issues that need a few key cabinet members around the table in the Oval Office, for example, discussing issues and giving the president updates on implementation and management and those kinds of things as well.
Tim.
I suppose one of the interesting questions is, does the service in the president's cabinet lead to anything bigger than just having that particular position? And it is important to note that having been Secretary of State, which is equivalent to a a minister of foreign affairs or whatever, often, well, six, I think it is, secretaries of state have gone on to the presidency. So there is some cachet to being a cabinet officer. But when it comes to just to pure power, physical proximity to the president, so it might be better to be the director of the president's economic council or council of economic advisors, or to be the national security advisor, than it would be necessarily to be the secretary of state, just because you're with the president every day and see him at key moments.
Okay, we're going to go away just for a minute, but on our way out, we're going to listen to Hillary Clinton, January 22nd, 2009, this bit of archival tape, Hillary Clinton arriving for her first day at the U.S. State Department to address the staff at the U.S. State Department. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
This is going to be a challenging time, and it will require 21st century tools and solutions to meet our problems and seize our opportunities. I'm going to be asking a lot of you. I want you to think outside the proverbial box. I want you to give me the best advice you can. I want you to understand there is nothing that I welcome more than a good debate and the kind of dialogue that will make us better.
Hillary Clinton in 2009. We'll be back with more of presidents and their cabinets and staff members.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, a community of entrepreneurs, freelancers, and remote workers who believe that life is better when you work together. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Find your tribe.
It's a lot of women that's coming out, you know, and expressing themselves about what happened to them.
I really hope the Me Too movement is propelling us in that direction where assaulting people has consequences.
I think it's important that we listen to all of the women that are coming out and telling their stories and work on how we can engage them in a healing process.
The Me Too movement has led many people to share their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault. It has sparked conversations and controversy and maybe even change. I'm Charity Nebbe. Look for Unsettled, Mapping Me Too, a new podcast from Iowa Public Radio in the iTunes Store and on Google Play, or find it at iowapublicradio.org.
So glad to have you with us on this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, examining U.S. presidents, their cabinets, and senior staff through the lens of history, how the presidents, their advisors, their administrators have evolved over time. Donna Hoffman is with us, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Walch, presidential historian, former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. If you'd like to join us in this half hour with your questions or comments about the history of presidential cabinets and their staff, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Well, let's talk a little bit more about we talked a little bit about confirmation, Donna. How does that shape a cabinet member? And I know there have been changes recently. The cabinet member has to be, to some degree, to the liking of the Senate, right?
That's correct. So these officials are nominated by the president. Then those nominations go to the Senate. Now, generally speaking, and we should be clear to distinguish these kinds of presidential nominations from judicial ones.
Mm-hmm.
But these kinds of nominations to the executive branch, the president tends to get a lot of deference from the Senate here. That is, the president tends to get who he or she would want for these particular positions, absent some kind of wrongdoing. But this is a process, and the process has gotten a little more lengthy and a little more involved over the years. You know, so for example, back in the late 70s, the financial disclosures and looking at conflict of interest started to be something that would happen before they would get through Senate confirmation. So we have had, so it's pretty rare that the Senate would vote down someone who the president had nominated. The last time this happened was in 1989. John Tower, himself a former senator, was nominated for Secretary of Defense by the first President Bush, and his nomination was actually voted down in the Senate. That's the last time that's happened, and there were only three of those in the 20th century. What typically happens now is a name is floated. Sometimes once the name is floated, there might be negative reaction and that person isn't nominated. But you will then have some who are nominated that will have their nomination withdrawn. So before it gets to a full vote in the Senate, there are enough signals that the person's not going to survive and those nominations are withdrawn. What tends to happen here historically is there's some kind of wrongdoing that comes out in the financial disclosure or a conflict of interest. Some recent of these, Tom Daschle was slated to be the head of HHS in the first Obama administration. It turned out that he failed to pay some taxes on some perks that he got working as a consultant, and so his nomination was withdrawn. In the Trump administration, we've seen a couple of these. One kind of unusual, Ronny Jackson, who was, if you recall, the president's personal physician in the administration of the White House, and Trump nominated him to be Secretary of Veteran Affairs. He was also a Navy officer. And that got a lot of pushback from the Senate because there was a lot of questioning, not of his medical credentials, but that wasn't what he was being appointed to. He was being appointed to Veterans Affairs, but to his lack of managerial experience. And again, going back to what are these people required to do? One of the things they're required to do is manage their agency, and Veterans Affairs is actually one of the larger agencies. And so that nomination was pulled for, you know, quite frankly, lack of qualification. Pretty unusual.
So either wrongdoing or egregious, perhaps, lack of qualification.
Right.
Some leeway given there, though.
Right. And we have Andrew Pudzder, who was nominated for Secretary of Labor by Trump. And there were some issues of spousal abuse that were reported, but also not employing an undocumented immigrant, not paying taxes on. That one comes up frequently. Mistreatment of workers within his own business, and his nomination, or he withdrew his nomination as well. So that's typically what you've seen. The writing becomes on the wall that these people aren't going to survive Senate confirmation, and they don't survive.
They need that confirmation, some of these posts, but then they serve at the leisure of the president, and then they can be axed with only the president's axe in hand, so to speak. Tim, Walsh, take us back to what you think is an interesting cabinet, an interesting cabinet member, or a set of cabinet members that you think is particularly notable.
Well, let's talk about Iowa's own Herbert Hoover, just to mention the fact that he's one of the very few individuals who's gone from being a cabinet officer to being a presidential nominee and president of the United States. William Howard Taft was a cabinet officer who eventually goes on to become the Republican nominee and then president of the United States, as did Hoover. But I'd also like to mention a controversial cabinet member, and that's Robert Kennedy, who, of course, becomes his brother's attorney general. And the question is, should two brothers serve in the same cabinet? And yet Robert Kennedy became critically important to the president, not only for his frank advice, but also during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Robert Kennedy left us a terrific diary of what was going on. And that was a situation, too, where you have a common crisis, where members from different departments and different areas of government come together and deal with this common problem and share ideas and form a strategy that it really informs and advises the president. We've seen this kind of jumping back and forth in World War One, when you've got a major issue as to whether or not the United States should enter the war. And then once we do enter the war, President Wilson brought together all of the members of the various departments to say we are working in one common cause to win this war. So if you've got a common cause, then the cabinet can work together. But if you've got all the disparate different functions of government, the sitting around a table won't do very, very much good. So the Postmaster General doesn't have to talk about Laos. Of course, now the Postmaster General is not part of the cabinet.
Right.
So
I want to make sure we make good on our trivia questions at the start of the hour. I am in charge here. One of the quotes from a cabinet member of a previous administration. We have the audio here, but I don't know. Donna, do you want to set the scene and do the reveal here?
Well, that happened in March of 1981 when President Ronald Reagan had been shot. And was incapacitated in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's listen to a little bit of that. This is in March of 1981, chaos sort of ensuing behind the scenes at the White House. Well, I don't know. We'll ask, was there any protocol in place for such a situation? Everyone involved had seemingly sort of improvising here. Of course, you want to keep people calm at such a time. Here's Al Haig, Reagan's Secretary of State, on national TV.
And there are absolutely no alert measures that are necessary at this time or contemplate. Now, if you have some questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Crisis management, that put into effect when you arrived?
Crisis management is in effect.
Who is making the decisions for the government right now? Who's making the decisions?
Constitutionally, gentlemen, you have the president, the vice president, and the secretary of state in that order. And should the president decide he wants to transfer the helm to the vice president, he will do so.
Who makes that decision?
As of now, I am in control here in the White House, pending return of the vice president, and in close touch with him. If something came up, I would check with him, of course.
Okay, I am in control here. Now, what's wrong with that, Tim?
Well, so many things. Probably a poor choice of words. What I think the secretary was referring to, of course, he was the first among equals among cabinet officers, but he was not the third in line of succession to the presidency.
The president is being operated on.
The president is being operated on. The vice president is on an airplane, so he was not in direct communication with the White House at that point. Of course, we had the 25th Amendment. The President Reagan could have passed authority to the vice president if necessary. It was not deemed necessary at the time. And then if something untoward had happened to the vice president and the president, the Speaker of the House succeeds to the presidency, not the Secretary of State. And it made General Haig, as he was often referred to, a little bit out of control. I mean,
it was mocked.
It was mocked. He lasted only about 18 months as Secretary of State. It just wasn't a good fit. At the end of the day, it's what poor Al Haig has lived with the rest of his life, that he's in charge, you know.
Donna.
I would say that, you kind of you hear a lot of emotion, I think, in Haig's voice in that clip. But people didn't react very well to that choice of words, and then also not really understand. Or, I mean, sure he understood it, but in a crisis situation, he's saying, oh, I'm in charge. And what he was really referring to was he was in charge within the White House, and, yeah, and that is true, but he wasn't, you know, really in charge in terms of the presidential line of succession, as,
right,
as we pointed
and,
out.
And he said, you know, any decisions, I'll check with the vice president. Like, he was going to make the decision.
Right.
You could interpret it that way. He was going to make the decision and then see if it's all right with the vice president.
Right. And you know, in terms of the day-to-day running of the White House is essentially what he was talking about, even though we should note here he was Secretary of State. So it's not as if he was involved in the day-to-day running of the White House, because he wasn't one of those staffers, as we were talking about.
Okay.
Yeah. And I just argue, too, of course, President Reagan, although at this point probably it wasn't as well known, had sort of a troika of three advisors who really probably had more power than Al Haig in the position of Jim Baker and Mike Deaver and Ed Meese, who really were close to the president and were running the government.
Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of context for this quote. Perhaps one of you do, but it's one of the things that jumped into my memory as we prepared this show. And it is an interesting quote, just because it seems to make no sense. Or if you think about it, it does make sense. From a press conference in February 2002, we are ramping up. Remember, a year from this date is when we enter the Iraq War. So here's a quote from Donald Rumsfeld, defense secretary at that time under George W. Bush. One of the quotes he has to be best known for. Let's listen to it and perhaps get some dissection afterwards.
Reports that say that something hasn't happened are always interesting to me, because as we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
Okay. The reveal for one of our trivia questions. Donald Rumsfeld from February 2002. Your thoughts on that, Donna?
Well, this came off as this got parodied quite a bit, right? And unknown unknowns and known unknowns became kind of catchphrases that people would use. What, you know, to be charitable to Rumsfeld, he was trying to refer to the complexity of these decisions and unintended consequences, for example. And, you know, this is something that, as we have gotten further away from, actually looks better for Rumsfeld. He even titled, I think, his book, some variant of known unknowns. So it's not something that he really was shamefaced about, because he was inarticulately, perhaps, but really trying to refer to a framework that sometimes is used in terms of thinking about, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, here are potential unintended consequences. And the longer we go on in time, that I think looks a little better,
mm-hmm,
in terms of the framework, even though certainly at the time it was much parody.
It's something of a reminiscent of who's on first. You know, it's the mangled language more than it is the substance of what Rumsfeld was talking about. It's important, too, to note Donald Rumsfeld was the youngest person ever to serve as Secretary of Defense and the oldest person to
in
serve
what administrations?
Well, first in the I think it was the Ford administration, and then again in the administration of George W. Bush. So you have a span of 30 years or so between these two tenures. So he was a deep thinker on issues related to defense, controversial, of course. But he is tagged in part with that sort of mangled phrase.
Mm-hmm. Tim Walsh with us, Donna Hoffman as well, as we finish up this hour, as we consider presidents and their White House staff, their cabinets, through a historical lens. One other bit of archive audio I wanted to have you comment on, a theme that runs through presidents and their advisors. Donna, you mentioned, you know, we have the department heads in charge of sometimes just huge bureaucracies. But also, this is a person who is an advisor often to the president. Let's listen to a bit of archive audio from April 17th of 1973. 1973, you know what's going on then. This is part of a conversation with President Richard Nixon and his then National Security Advisor, Henry Kissinger. I understand this conversation took place around midnight, and in it you will hear Nixon emotionally discussing this growing Watergate scandal and the possibility of having to fire his chief of staff Haldeman. So if I'm interpreting this correctly, and my guest can recorrect this if you want to, this is where to put the blame. Who's going to get the blame for what's happening? Watergate. Let's listen.
Well, rather a hard day, wasn't it? Well, it was hard for you. Yeah. When I didn't know you had made the statement you did until the evening. When I think of the discipline with which you conducted the meeting in the morning.
And then going through the evening.
And then going through the evening.
You know. The problem I have is that I can't look at it in the detached way I really should. Well, these people, goddamn it, they're guilty. Throw them out and go on. But just the personal things are, goddamn. I think of these good men.
That's right. Who wanted to do the right thing. And,
well, it's going to splash on a lot of them. And anyway.
Well, I think the way you have positioned it now is the right way to do it.
Because Garment, as you know, was having the idea that I should get up and announce that I'd fired Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and Dean. And that, I mean, without waiting until they get up and name the real culprit is Mitchell, of course. He's in charge of the whole goddamn thing, and John Mitchell should step up like a man and say, look, I was in charge. I take the responsibility, period.
Exactly. All the more so as doing the opposite won't help them any.
Nope. They're going to get him.
I think to fire Haldeman would make him the villain.
Okay. National Security Advisor then, Henry Kissinger, 1973, April, with President Richard Nixon. Donna Hoffman, when you hear that archive audio, tell us some of your thoughts.
Well, you know, that's actually, you know, the first thing I thought of when hearing this is Haldeman would go on to serve 18 months in prison for perjury, conspiracy, and obstruction of justice. And I have seen a couple of references to Haldeman recently when President Trump was trying to find a new chief of staff, as we know that he has just recently done that. And he was having difficulty finding people, apparently, to be his chief of staff. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why, potentially, because if you're that close to the seat of power, you're going to know lots of things, and you may have mounting legal bills, and you may have grand juries you have to go sit before. And there was a real hesitation, I think, given current circumstances on the part of certain people who might, in a normal administration, have been slated to be a chief of staff and might have even jumped at that opportunity, that did not at this particular time in this particular administration.
Right. And I don't know if this is normal, but I understand now, to be part of the president's inner circle, you have to lawyer up. You need your lawyer, right, Tim?
Without question. In fact, this whole position of being chief of staff has become very problematic. There have been, I read recently, 19, I think Mick Mulvaney would be 19th, 19 chiefs of staff of the president since 1988. I mean, it's just a revolving door of a position. It's a meat grinder. It's difficult to be the guardian or gatekeeper for the presidency. And you end up knowing far more than you should. You're at the seat of power. You don't have any real power yourself. You serve at the pleasure of the president, and you have to work as hard as you can to convince the president to do the right thing and to tell the president the truth. And that can be very difficult and problematic if the president doesn't like that advice or doesn't want that advice or insists on being their own chief of staff.
An interesting thing we haven't considered yet, Donna, would you comment on diversity within presidential cabinets? Some presidents make that a real high goal, don't they? And others not so much.
Some do. And so, you know, if you look at pictures of cabinets historically, it was not until Franklin Roosevelt would appoint Francis Perkins to be Secretary of Labor back in the early part of his administration. So you didn't have a lot of diversity, first in terms of gender. Then you started to get a little bit of that. And then we started to get diversity being important in terms of ethnicity. And there's a lot of factors that go into who presidents pick, of which looking at the cabinet holistically can be one. And so even Bill Clinton, in his campaigning, one of the things he talked about was trying to have a cabinet that looked more like America. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the individual people and their criteria are important, but then looking at the cabinet as a whole can be important as well to signal to the public that the president is serious about diverse viewpoints, having women, having Hispanics, having African Americans and others serve in these various positions. And so this is something that presidents can keep an eye towards, not just looking at who's the best individual for these positions, but then collectively, what does the cabinet look like?
Mm-hmm. Notable here, an Iowa connection, the longest serving cabinet member, if I'm getting this right, served the entire 8 years of the Obama administration from Iowa, former Governor Tom Vilsack.
Tom Vilsack. And in fact, secretaries of agriculture have been very commonly from the state of Iowa. You have a stretch from about 1896 to about 1936 or 38, where all but about four of those years, the position of secretary of agriculture was occupied by an Iowan. Mm-hmm. So it's Iowa is obviously known for its farms and its produce and its product and also leadership in agricultural issues.
Okay. Well, unless we had some final words, Donna Hoffman and Tim Walsh, thank you for such an enjoyable hour. We appreciate you coming to our studio. Donna Hoffman, professor of political science at the University of Northern Iowa. Tim Walsh, presidential historian and former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Wonderful. Thank you, Donna. Thank you, Tim.
Glad to be with you.
Glad to be here.
And Politics Wednesday tomorrow on our program. Lots to pick apart there. Our program is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Theme music written and performed by the River Monks. We always enjoy your comments, your questions. Perhaps you have a historical show idea you'd like to toss up for us to consider. You can write us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.